This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest counts himself as one of the moderate Muslim intellectuals living in the West who are fighting for the very soul of their religion, fighting against extremists who believe that true and faithful Muslims should rejoice at the spread of terror. What gives him special insight into the minds of extremists is that he was briefly one himself as a young teenager. Khalid Abu al-Fadl grew up in Egypt and Kuwait. Now in his late 30s, he is a professor of law at UCLA, where he teaches Islamic law, Middle Eastern law, anti-terrorism law, and immigration law. He is the author of several books, including Speaking in God's Name, Islamic Law, Authority, and Women. His next book, Tolerance in Islam, is due out this fall. I asked him what he found appealing about the extremist form of Islam that he gravitated to when he was young.
I was attracted by the feeling it gave me, the high. I can describe it as a high of confidence. You just feel so secure and confident in your beliefs that suddenly your view of life becomes very, very simplified and very streamlined, and you have a superhuman level of confidence in what you can do.
Can you think of examples of things that were plaguing you with doubt and how those doubts disappeared after you became an extremist?
Well, the types of social frustrations that I remember very clearly were an extreme level of displeasure at the way the society in which I lived, both in Kuwait and Egypt, were structured. In other words, there were kids who came from elite families or families connected to the government who had impunity. And I, from the family that I came from, I was, relative to these kids, I was a nobody. And for instance, one of the turning points in my life, I was once a kid who was from a prominent family, beat me up in the street in front of my brother and in front of friends, and I couldn't strike back because I knew that his family was well connected in the government, and that he could, if I as much as defended myself, he'll have me and thrown in prison and probably have my family hurt. And the degradation, I remember this, although I was at the time about 12 years old, I remember it as if it was yesterday, the feeling of utter degradation and humiliation. And when I joined I never actually formally joined, but when I became a part of the fundamentalist outlook in life, suddenly I felt very powerful. I felt I can challenge the world, not just this kid. And no one and nothing can touch me.
When you changed your life and you believe that the principles of Islam, the way you were following it and the way you were interpreting it, were the only way, the best way, the supreme way, did you try to change the lives of the people around you, your family, your friends?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the high. It's not only that the teachers who preach this type of intolerance, it's not only that they tell you that you're right, but they tell you that you have a right to display and exercise power over others. So I was going around, put it simply and bluntly, bossing my sister, especially my older sister, bossing her around. I was bossing around my mother. I tried to boss around my father. I was constantly fighting with my brother because I was constantly trying to boss him around. In fact, I remember that my uncle complained to my mother that I was such unpleasant social company, because every time they would take me to go see my uncle and my cousins, I would cause such amount of anxiety by simply going around with my nose stuck up in the air, commanding and ordering and saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. And I just, frankly, you know, I don't know how they put up with me.
Your family wasn't happy with the extremist form of Islam that you had begun to practice. Did your family help lead you out of it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, I was going on one of my fits, one of my rants, and I actually don't exactly remember what particular thing I was having a fit about that day, but I had gotten to the point that every single day I was having a fit about something my sister was doing or my brother was doing, or, you know, always calling it a sin and a blasphemy, and they're going to go to hell and so on. And I'm not quite sure why my father that particular day, normally he wouldn't respond to me. Normally he would just keep reading or working and just shake his head. And that day he closed his book, he looked up at me, and he said, "Okay, Khalid, since you are convinced that you know everything, and that your knowledge, that God speaks through you with such absoluteness, I'm going to strike a deal with you, and you know me, I'm a man of my word, and we will abide by this deal." And of course, I paid attention, and I said, "I'm going to present you with one challenge. You go and attend a class that I'm going to take you to on Islamic jurisprudence. And if you are able to answer all questions about that class, about the material presented in this class, one session, from now on, every member of this family is going to obey you blindly, as you want. We're just going to say whatever you do, whatever you say, you know, effectively become my slaves, because, of course, I was convinced that I knew everything. I spoke on behalf of God, after all."
So what was the test he gave you?
Well, he took me to a class in a different mosque than the one that I attended. And it was a class on Islamic jurisprudence. Actually, I remember the class well. It's on a field of Islamic law known as legal maxims. And I am sure, although he has never confirmed this till to this day, I am sure he had talked to the teacher beforehand, because the teacher kept asking me direct. You know, the style of teaching is very dialectical and what they call in law a Socratic method, where you pose a question and then people try to answer and then you show them how they're wrong and so on. And the teacher directed a lot of the questions to me. And every time I responded, not only was I wrong, but I had no clue what I was doing. So, for instance, he would pose one question and I would, of course, come in, "Well, the answer is clear, you know, God says in the Quran X." And then he would, the teacher would say, "Well, sure, he says X, but how about Y? And how about Z? And how about F and T?" In other words, for every Quranic verse I cited, he cited 10. For every tradition from the Prophet I cited, he cited 10 or 20. And the students themselves were shown such facility. I was destroyed. I mean, I came home and my father said, "How did it go?" He wasn't in the class. And I, of course, lied. I said, "Oh, it went fine." And then I went into my bedroom. I'm not quite sure why, but I crawled under my bed and I sobbed until my father came and asked me to come out from under the bed. After, I think I was, he had left me cry under the bed for about an hour. And then he finally came in and said, "Khaled, you know, this is not going to help. Come out." I'll never forget it, and I will for eternally be grateful for the wisdom and the patience that that he and my mother showed.
And then you ended up devoting your life to the study of Islamic law.
Absolutely.
My guest is Islamic scholar Khalid Abu al-Fadl. He teaches Islamic and Middle Eastern law at UCLA. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Khalid Abu al-Fadl. He's a professor of law at UCLA, where he teaches immigration law, national security law, law and terrorism, and Islamic law. Do you think of Islamic law as having a rich history of debate, of different interpretations?
Absolutely. The remarkable thing that I started, of course, learning, and as I continued on to become a jurist and so on, Islamic law, at one point in its history, it was the divine well, so to speak, was represented by no less than 130 different schools of interpretation. Every jurist, except of course the extremist schools that predominated in later parts of Islamic history, they always argued that you exercise the best judgment you can in trying to interpret or understand the divine will, but no one can understand, can be assured that they perfectly and absolutely understand the divine will or realize the divine will. And if you're wrong, if you exercise the best of your judgment and you're wrong, God rewards you once for the effort. If ultimately you're right, God rewards you twice. But you're even rewarded for being wrong. That was liberating. That was absolutely liberating.
In other words, you're rewarded for taking it seriously enough to consider it and deliberate
Absolutely.
About it. Yes. Let me ask you about something that we understand the terrorists, the suicide bombers, believe about the afterlife. You know, we've been told that, for instance, the people who destroyed the World Trade Center, that they probably believed that they were going to heaven, directly to heaven afterwards, where they would be met in paradise by virgins.
Right.
The implication being that, you know, the virgins would be available to them as well.
Right.
Where does that come from in the Quran, and what does that passage mean to you?
What I believe is that this is nothing more than a male erotic projection upon the text of the Quran. The Quran itself uses the word huri'in. Now, the expression huri'in is two words. Now, what that expression means in pre-Islamic poetry and in literary sources after Islam was revealed, it usually refers to something very pure, something pure and beautiful, or it's sometimes referred to beautiful horses, sometimes referred to simply beautiful souls. Now,
beautiful souls?
Souls, mm-hmm. Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is one tradition attributed to the Prophet in which the prophet supposedly says that the martyrs will be in the company of female virgins. In that tradition, it's not referring to an expression that could be, that it should be read as purified souls, but it actually specifies virginal women, and in fact specifies a number, and so on. Now, but if you come from a scholastic point of view, from the juristic point of view, if you go back to the sources written on Islamic traditions, going back to 1200 years, consistently, Islamic juristic sources said that this tradition is too isolated, with too many problems in the way it was transmitted and reached us, to be relied upon on a matter of theology, that it's too weak for it to establish a theological belief. I mean, the commonsensical point that if you're going to adopt a theological belief, you better base it on something that you're fairly sure, there is at least a probability that the Prophet actually said. Well, that tradition, we can't even reach a probability. There is only a 10% chance, if that, that the Prophet actually said it.
Terrorists have used the Quran to justify their attacks on Westerners and on Israelis as well. Now, there's a couple of quotes that you hear quoted,
mm-hmm.
for justification. The Quran commands Muslims to fight the unbelievers, quote, until there is no more tumult or oppression and until faith and all judgment belongs to God.
Right.
Or, fight those among the people of the book who do not believe in God or the hereafter, who do not forbid what God and his prophet have forbidden, and who do not acknowledge the religion of truth. Is the Quran telling Muslims to fight people who aren't Muslims?
these verses that you have quoted are being read out of, taken out of a historical context, out of a textual context, that if they are implemented absolutely without reservations, without qualifications, without thinking about, well, what are they really referring to here? They would contradict other parts of the Quran. And they would, in fact, void, cancel, and abrogate other parts of the Quran.
Which parts of the Quran do they contradict?
Well, they contradict parts of the Quran that says it is the divine will that people will remain different till the very last day. In fact, the Quran tells us specifically that until the very last day, the earth will not become Muslim. So if these verses are read to mean fight until everyone becomes Muslims, as bin Laden reads them, well, it seems that we are going against what the Quran tells us is the divine will. The Quran also says, we have made you different, nations and tribes, and made you different, and you will remain different. And then explains that the reason God did this is so that we will get to know one another. So they contradict the idea, since war is not the best way of getting to know the other, they contradict the idea of the necessary discourse to get to know the other.
So if you think that the passages that I read have been taken out of context by the terrorists who use them, put them back into historical context for us.
Well, the historical context is the Prophet existed in a socio-historical context that was very hostile. And the Prophet needed support. And the Quran tells Muslims, support the Prophet. Now, I, for one, am not willing to give any other human being the same status of the Prophet and to lend the type of support that the Quran demanded for the Prophet to any other human being. The bin Laden is not the Prophet, not even comes in the proximity of the Prophet. So the fact that the Quran tells us or commands Muslims to support the Prophet doesn't mean that I support bin Laden.
So you're saying that when the Quran commands Muslims to fight the unbelievers until there's no more tumult or oppression, that was a reference to a particular battle in a particular period in a particular war. It wasn't meant to say all the time you have to fight unbelievers.
Absolutely. And under the leadership of a particular man, and that is the Prophet Muhammad.
Right. Now, I'm wondering if you think that the sheikhs and imams and terrorist leaders who interpret the Quran in a very extreme way, if you think that they really believe that in their heart of hearts, or if you're more cynical about that and you think that they just want power and they're using the Quran as a tool to help them get it.
I believe that what really motivates them is a desire for empowerment. They, for a variety of complex reasons, feel disempowered and frustrated by this disempowerment. And they invent a theology of power, as I refer to it in some of my writings.
So you think that they've reinvented the Quran in order to get power because they feel it's disenfranchised?
Well, yes. And I also feel that the morality of the text, you know, how ethical a text is, depends to a good part, not in all parts, but to a good part, on the morality of the reader. And the Prophet has a tradition in which he says, those of you who are moral before Islam are going to remain moral after Islam. And I read that to mean that, you know, if an immoral person, if a power-hungry person, if a person who wants to dominate women and oppress the other, reads the Quran, reads the Old Testament, reads the New Testament, they will draw these conclusions from the text. Not the text is not somehow going to reinvent their psychology.
Khalid Abu El Fadl teaches Islamic law and Middle Eastern law at UCLA. His next book, Tolerance in Islam, is scheduled for publication this fall. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Khalid Abu El Fadl. He counts himself a moderate Muslim intellectual who is appalled by extremists who use the Quran to justify terrorism. He teaches Islamic law and Middle Eastern law at UCLA and is the author of several books, including Speaking in God's Name, Islamic Law, Authority, and Women. You've expressed your concern that you think extremists are kind of stealing Islam away from other believers. And you've been critical of the American Muslim leadership. Right. What are your reasons?
Well, I've been critical of, first as to the issue of stealing. The problem is that, yes, there has been a long, rich history of humanistic Islam. I mean, the Muslim contributions to human civilizations are beyond dispute, whether in philosophy, mathematics, sciences, and so on. The problem, though, is that one cannot rest on their laurels and expect that somehow, magically, that the same beauty that once existed will always exist. And I think that the extremists are transforming Islamic theology instead of a system of thought that leads towards civilization, into a system of thought that is fundamentally deconstructive of civilization, fundamentally destructive of, and here what I mean by civilization is humanism. That's what I mean. As to the American Muslim leadership, I think, to put it simply, that there is way too much political correctness in the way this leadership conducts itself. That for many years, the priority has been on cheerleading Islam in the most apologetic sense, on not engaging in critical thinking and critical self-reflection and critical evaluation of the tradition. Every time someone opens their mouth about negative elements within the negative groups, negative orientations, within the current Islamic context, this leadership will often raise the claim of, oh, you're creating divisions and you're creating strife and we Muslims must be united and we should not criticize each other, regardless of how immoral the conduct that we see our fellow Muslim is engaging in. And we only, in my view, this leadership has tended to condemn the conduct of a fellow Muslim only when non-Muslims, particularly in the non-Muslim media, Western media, puts the spotlight on that leadership and says, well, you know, are you going to condemn this or not? And then at that point, they condemn. So they're not moral leaders. They simply act in a largely reactive, knee-jerk mode instead of grabbing moral leadership for Islam.
Is it dangerous for you to talk that way? Have you been harassed or threatened?
Oh yeah, plenty. I mean, I don't know who's issuing these threats, and I don't want to imply that it's a Muslim American leadership. That would be slander. But someone, and I don't know who these parties are, is, you know, started threatening and to the point that the police was involved and so on. But I want to say this, that as a point of encouragement for other Muslims out there and critical thinkers and youth that are tired of this mummified intellectual atmosphere that exists, that if you're determined and this definitely applies to me, if you're determined, if you truly believe that this is your Islamic duty, that this is what God wants from you, you're irrepressible. I mean, I've been on blacklists, I've been thrown out, I've been threatened, I've been even beaten and struck at different times, but I carry credibility and the credibility of knowledge and honesty.
What would you like to see the American Muslim leadership do or say vis-a-vis extremism and terrorism?
I would like us to stop playing political games. You know, let's call, although it's not maybe appropriate to use that expression because I don't play poker, but let's call a spade a spade. You know, as a Muslim, I don't gamble and so on. But, okay. You know, let's call things as they are. So we've got a problem with a serious Puritan form of Islam called Wahhabism. No one in the Muslim leadership is willing to condemn it because they are scared of the reaction of the Saudis or the reaction of the rich people who believe in this form and so on. Well, my honest belief is that you betray your tradition when you play politics at the expense of Islamic morality. I would have liked to see a very, very, very different response to 9/11. I would have liked to see this leadership make a thunderous, resounding, unequivocal response to 9/11 to basically send a message very loud and clear to the terrorists that you don't represent us in any way, and not because we're afraid of retaliation or anything like that, but because we firmly believe that this is not and cannot be Islam. I would have liked the leadership to organize a massive march led by Muslims, where we go to Ground Zero and each Muslim would deposit a flower or a card and that it would be something of, you know, thousands. I would have liked to see the leadership issue a unified statement signed by every Muslim organization, clearly telling and saying that bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and their whole theology and system of belief is something that we absolutely reject. And I would like this statement to have been signed by every Muslim organization, to be unified, to be clear, to be unequivocal, and so on. I mean, there are so many different things that we could have done in response to even something as horrific and ugly as 9/11.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Khalid Abu El Fadl teaches Islamic and Middle Eastern law at UCLA. His next book, Tolerance in Islam, is scheduled for publication this fall. This is Fresh Air.